You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, and we hope you have a great Kwanzaa and a Happy New Year.
Welcome to this holiday edition of the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm Michael Robert Cadence. Today I'll give a short talk on free will, and also a short talk on objectivity versus subjectivity when it comes to philosophy of mind. I hope you enjoy the show. Talk a little bit about what is commonly known as free will, and perhaps deconstruct some of the common notions surrounding free will. The first thing I want to do is do away, at least for my purposes at the moment, with the term free. I'm not sure what that really adds to the concept of will, but for my purposes, I'm just going to talk about will. Human beings possessing will, the will to make things happen, to make decisions and then implement the decisions. The question is, do people have this will that is so commonly believed to be something humans possess? I want to dispel one of the notions I believe is common around will, human will. The idea that humans don't have will, the claim that humans don't have will, entails that everything is predetermined. The idea is that when somebody claims humans don't have will, then that person is saying, by implication, that that person's behavior is determined, is part of a causal chain, which began a long, long time ago, perhaps with the Big Bang. And that notion that human behavior is determined is quite objectionable and implausible to many. The idea that what I'm going to have for lunch today was already determined at the time of the Big Bang, it just seems to many to be implausible and is good reason to reject the claim that people don't have will. Because certainly it seems, from common sense, that people make decisions and then implement those decisions, and they might have chosen differently. They might have chosen differently. If someone could have chosen differently, then that is the argument why humans have will, or free will, as it's commonly called. Because a person made a choice but could have chosen differently. Thus, that person exercised will to implement the option of his or her choice. I'm free to choose between option A or option B. But that's not particularly relevant to my claim here. My claim surrounds the idea that humans can will anything to be. I want to dispense with the notion, with the objection to a denial of free will or denial of will. I want to dispense with the objection that it can't be the case that humans don't have will, because it certainly is not the case that everything is predetermined. An argument that humans do not have will, that cannot will things to happen, does not entail that human behavior is predetermined. There is at least one way I can think of, one model, by which humans cannot will things to happen, and yet those things that will happen are not predetermined, and that is related to recent discoveries, and I say recent in the past few decades, around quantum physics. I can't get into the details of quantum physics, and also I'm no expert on quantum physics, but I can tell you that many models of quantum physics have something in common, which is that events, at least at a quantum scale or in a quantum machine, happen randomly, are not predetermined, but happen randomly. It's plausible, but by no means certain, that a human brain is a quantum machine, that the quantum behavior of particles, or the behavior of quantum particles in a human brain, percolate upwards, and since they are constituents of the human brain behaves like its constituent particles. If this is the case, the human brain may be a quantum machine, and the events that happen or the behavior that humans exhibit may be random. So if I am sitting at a restaurant, I'm handed a menu, I look at the menu, and there are a number of options. It may be a random chance as to which option I will choose. Not predetermined, but random. And I'll go back and talk about how it could be random in a moment, but if indeed the choice I'm about to make from the menu at the restaurant is random, I can still argue that I don't have will. So how can that be? Because there are various forces in play that will affect the probability that I will order each menu item. So in theory, a probability curve could be drawn, which would display the chances of ordering the steak versus the chances of ordering the hamburger versus the chances of ordering pizza. Each of those options could be assigned a probability, and then which one actually I choose is a matter of random chance, governed by those probabilities. My argument is that will is not required to explain which item I will finally choose. I don't need to invoke a concept of will to explain why one item might get chosen over another. Now, it's possible that determinism is correct, and it's been predetermined since the history of the universe that I'm going to order a hamburger. If that's implausible to people, then they may want to consider that it's not predetermined which item I will order, but it might be highly probable that I will order a hamburger because I love hamburgers. I haven't had one in 3 months. I feel in the mood for a hamburger. I'm not quite hungry enough for a steak. And my intention when I came to this restaurant wasn't to order pizza, because I'd rather get pizza at a pizza restaurant. I know it's going to be better. So there seemed to be a high probability because of these various forces at work that I'll order a hamburger, but it's certainly not certain. There's other things that could interfere with my choice of ordering a hamburger. There could be a sudden fire in the restaurant and everyone's evacuated and I didn't order the hamburger. Or maybe I start ordering the hamburger and the server tells me that they're out of hamburgers, so I wind up with something else. Or maybe just before I open my mouth to order the hamburger, I suddenly faint and didn't order the hamburger, didn't order anything. Or maybe I misspoke and said steak when I really meant hamburger, even though I intended to order hamburger. So the point is that I'm going to place an order or not. Something's going to happen, but I don't need to invoke the concept of will to explain what happens. What happens is a result of the various forces in play, and the strongest one wins. If I faint and can't order the hamburger, then that was the strongest force, and it trumped any quote-unquote decision I made. Another example, think about a bag of potato chips that I just can't stop eating. I say to myself, this will be the last potato chip. And after eating it, I say to myself, I am now invoking my will, my free will, to stop eating potato chips. 10 seconds later, my hand reaches into the bag and grabs another potato chip. I just can't stop myself. My will, my alleged will, did not seem to work. Now you could say, well, will doesn't always work, but I think it's more reasonable in my view to say, well, will is a fictitious notion. Whether I have the potato chip or not is not governed by will. It's governed by things like desire, beliefs, what my stomach feels like, whether my hand works. What if I have a sudden cramp in my hand and I cannot will myself to reach in and get another potato chip? There's all kinds of things that can influence whether or not I eat that potato chip. What if I will myself, supposedly, to eat the potato chip? I reach my hand down into the bag and I grab a potato chip, and suddenly, since I was driving my car while I was eating, I hear a siren behind me, and I, lo and behold, don't eat the potato chips. Some external event interfered with my alleged will. I could not will myself to eat that potato chip because some external event interfered with the causal chain. Now, some people may object to my model and say, well, are you telling me that I'm not a rational being, that I can't think about the pros and cons of various options before me and then make a choice? Are you telling me that I'm just like a machine with no control over myself and things just happen to me? That can't be the case, because when I am at a store thinking about which product to buy on the shelf, I think about it. My hand doesn't just go to some item on the shelf, doesn't go to the vanilla ice cream, doesn't go to the crackers. I think about it. I might even read the label and weigh the cost versus how much I'm going to enjoy it or whether I already have some at home. Obviously, I'm a thinking, rational being. So you can't deny that I make choices. Well, what I would say to that is, of course you are a rational thinking being. Of course we weigh the pros and cons of various options before us. And then we believe that we make a decision, or sometimes we don't make a decision. Sometimes things just sort of happen. But let's say that we believe we've made a decision. After painstakingly examining the options, we make a decision and then implement the decision. We obviously have, the objection goes to my model, we obviously can will ourselves as rational beings to make decisions. But my answer to that is that we might gather information and do a rational analysis of the options before us, but that quote-unquote decision we come to, if we come to one, is not the thing that causes the behavior. The decision does not cause the action. There is no will that implements a decision. Now, the knowledge that I acquired as a rational being through my fact-gathering project as to which product to buy based on the ingredients and the cost, that knowledge is one of the factors, one of the causal factors, one of the items in the causal set that will result in behavior. The balance of all of the causal items, of all the items in the causal set, on balance, depending on their weight, will produce a net result, and then the decision will come from that. But the decision or the behavior will result from that. The behavior will result from that. It will result from the weight of the various factors which are part of the causal set. Will is not involved. We do not need to invoke this, what I believe is fictitious concept of will, to explain our behavior. Our behavior results from a causal set. And depending on the weight of each of those causes, our behavior will be A or B or C or D. Now, that model is consistent with a quantum mechanical model of probability curves, probability distributions, which govern the likelihood that any particular event will occur. Will isn't required, nor is determinism required. I would suggest that will is a fictitious concept that arose perhaps not for the first time, but was a huge factor in medieval times amongst theologians who promoted the Judeo-Christian model of choice with respect to loving God or loving Christ. Loving Christ not being Judeo, but being Christian. But God being a Judeo-Christian God. And the idea amongst the medieval theologians, the belief was that humans are free to choose to love God or to not love God, to obey God or to not obey God, to obey the church or not obey church, to obey the teachings of Jesus or not obey the teachings of Jesus. And by that choice, one will ultimately finally seal his or her fate in the next life, going to heaven, going to hell. Now, that entire model of heaven versus hell would not really work if it weren't for the claim that humans have this free will, which they can exercise either rightly or wrongly, and be rewarded if they act rightly and punished if they act wrongly. Or actually, they're born sinners. People are born sinners, and they can redeem themselves only through virtuous obedience to God and the church and the teachings of Jesus Christ. Choice and will are required for that model, because if one could not will him or herself to act according to the teachings of the church, then one could not be held accountable or responsible or punishable if one willed sin rather than virtue. If human behavior were predetermined, one could hardly be held to account and punished for something that he or she had no choice over. So it's very important to the teachings of the church to maintain what I believe is a fictitious idea of will. So if we eliminate will from the picture, I don't see any reason why we can't continue to believe that our futures are not predetermined, that our futures are a result of many, many factors, which include our rationality, which include our desires, which include our instincts. Many, many things form a causal set which result in an effect. Past trauma, for example. All of the emotional, psychological, sociological reasons why people behave the way they behave. None of those are precluded or eliminated or discounted by elimination of will. In fact, they may be bolstered. Cultural pressure, normative cultural values, fear of being stigmatized, fear of being marginalized, meeting needs for acceptance, for respect, for recognition, meeting needs for safety, physical safety, for sustenance, for food, for water, for shelter. All of those things together form a causal set in a causal chain which results in effects. But will isn't required. So in summary, I assert that will is a fictitious construction designed to create the idea that people are either good or bad, that they either will things that are virtuous or will things that are sinful. And I argue that that's fictitious. Now, what about crime and punishment? What about being held responsible? What about just deserts? That's another matter. And I do have an argument how the criminal justice system is not made moot or should not be eliminated, even if one accepts that humans cannot will things to happen. There still is a reason why it can be perfectly justifiable to have reward and punishment. But that's another matter. And I'll make that argument separately at another time. short talk, I'm going to borrow from the ideas of a couple contemporary philosophers. One is John Searle, and the other is Donald Davidson. John Searle talks about the distinction between ontologically objective versus ontologically subjective entities, and similarly, the distinction between observer independent versus observer dependent or observer relative entities. And Donald Davidson promotes a theory of mind which he calls anomalous monism. So I'm going to tie those two together, weave those two together with my own theory or theories. An example of John Searle's ideas can be found in money. So think about currency, let's say a $20 bill. That $20 bill has two types of value or entities associated with it, at least two. But the two I want to talk about are quite distinct from each other, and one is the physical matter which constitutes a $20 bill. It might be made out of paper or plastic or a combination thereof. There's ink on it in a certain design, in a certain configuration. The ink is laid out in a certain way, certain colors. So we can call those various properties of the $20 bill the ontologically objective properties, the ontologically objective aspect or characteristics of the $20 bill. Ontologically objective because their existence is not dependent upon a subjective observer or any observer. If there were no human beings or any other living thing to experience, to observe that piece of paper or plastic with ink on it in a certain configuration, it presumably would still exist. The matter which constitutes that $20 bill would still exist. On the other hand, humans assign value to that $20 bill above and beyond the value of the matter which constitutes that bill. It signifies something in the economy, right? Something exchangeable. So you can exchange that $20 bill for goods and services. And presumably you acquired the $20 bill through either labor or selling goods or services. In economic terms, it's a vehicle for exchange. But that value of money in economic terms is ontologically subjective in that it only has that value because it is assigned that value by people. If there were no people, that value would be non-existent. The only thing there would be the matter, the constitutive matter. So the matter which constitutes the $20 bill and what one can do with it in human society are two distinct aspects or two distinct values of that $20 bill. The matter being ontologically objective, its existence is not dependent upon any observer, any subjective human mind or communities of human minds. But the fact that you can exchange that $20 bill for some goods or services is an ontologically subjective aspect of that $20 bill. Another way that you can look at that ontologically subjective characteristic of the $20 bill is that it is constructed. It is a constructed reality or institutional reality, as Searle